Today is August 22nd, 2019, and this is episode number 521 of the Apple Context Machine. That's a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Brian Chaffin, editor-in-chief of TMO, and please don't mind me. I'm just gathering information. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you'd like to comment or question, comment on, as it were, or question anything about the show, shoot us a note at macobserver.com/contextmachine. And on this particular Thursday, I am joined by the man everyone either loves or hates. There's no middle ground there, but I love him, John Keep.
Well, thank you. Some people love to hate me, though.
That's actually,
but still
that's,
part of your two bucket.
It
options,
is true. So. Yeah, right. That's not exclusive for my reality. but is a fine point to distinguish.
I thought the pedantic side of you will appreciate that. Anyway, Indeed. How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I can't wait for my renovation to be done. Other than that,
how much more you get to go? How's this taking so long?
And you could have totally built a house in almost any place other than Manhattan. So the original plan was 6 months, which passed about a week ago. And so it's been extended for a month. If it only goes over by a month, I'm going to consider that a victory. I'm walking away with the win.
Because I know that you actually trust your contractor.
Yeah, he's a great guy. He's a great guy. Very talented fella.
So what's taking so long?
It's just doing anything in Manhattan, which would be fodder for not just 10 hours of shows. It'd be like for, 10 seasons of shows of why you don't want to do any of that in Manhattan.
But yeah, I've had that.
Let's move on to easier topics like politics and religion before we
delve
down into working in Manhattan.
Fair enough. Politics and religion. Yeah, we definitely have a fine track record there.
we do.
Let's see here. Okay, but we have I think there's just a smidgen, of politics in our first topic.
Potentially. Yes, I think there is. And I will try to keep my personal politics out of it and talk about it more of as a policy issue. But you did a really good article. And I think you also followed it or preceded it with a podcast. And it's this notion that people, expect nothing about politics in their tech news. And while I can appreciate that, you don't go to a candy site to listen about someone's personal, politics because you're interested in candy or whatever it is that is your hobby or interest. But a lot of times, politics just and technology are intertwined hopelessly and endlessly.
Well, especially as Apple becomes
for better and for worse.
And more powerful.
So you have to deal with it. Yeah. You have to deal with it. Or you're not doing your job.
Right.
So I agree with you there.
And in this particular case, this is about that that letter that was 180 CEOs signed on to?
Actually, I was thinking it was about topic two more than topic one. But yeah, I could see how that could be political too. So it was the statement of purpose of a corporation, and it was signed by many CEOs.
I thought it was 120, 180. I don't know. It's a bunch. 181 CEOs who commit to lead their companies for the benefit of all stakeholders.
Yeah, you could find the entire manifesto at businessroundtable.org. They kind of aggregated all the press releases and whatnot and statements there at that site.
Okay, so here is the thing. When we first planned on talking about this, I think both of us really expected to have a fire and brimstone throwdown.
Yes, because of our personal politics differences. Yeah, I think that's fair.
And in part because I think what we really thought they were saying is something that you and I have actually discussed and argued about, which
Correct.
Is the responsibility of companies towards the communities that they're in.
Correct.
And, okay, so... Here's the thing, though. Here's my opening gambit, John.
Oh, okay. Should we actually maybe tell them what the statement of purpose is before we gambit around it?
Nope. I'm going to throw my opening gambit out, and then we'll explain what it is. My opening gambit is this. This is such a milquetoast statement. It means nothing, and there's no there.
And we agree. Next topic.
No, there is still something to talk about, though. There is still some aspect of this to talk about. So here is...
That was surprisingly unsurprising, I guess, is the way I would characterize that.
Well, it was being pitched as more...
Let's stop. For those that are... want to know what the heck are we talking about? So a bunch of CEOs says, look, corporations need to be better than they currently are. And they kind of characterize the way corporations as they currently are as these greedy entities that care about nothing but maximizing shareholder return.
And by law. That actually is the point, is by law.
Can't we do better than that? And it's the by law part is not completely accurate, but let's suss that out after I get it. So can't we do better? Can't we do better than the current state of affairs with law and otherwise for a corporation? And a bunch of folks, Tim Cook among them, CEOs, I'm not going to go all over the quotes, but they basically came up with 5 bullet points of what all the companies commit to. I'm going to read them because it's just quick enough and easy enough to do. So bullet point number one, we're going to deliver value to our customers. We will further the tradition of American companies leading the way in meeting or exceeding customer expectations. Okay, yeah, if you don't do that, odds are you're not going to stay in business. Yeah,
pardon me while I roll my eyes because...
Yeah, exactly.
Because duh.
Bullet point number two, investing in our employees. This starts with compensating them fairly and providing important benefits. It also includes supporting them through training and education that help develop new skills for a rapidly changing world. We foster diversity and inclusion, dignity, and respect. Okay, it means basically we're not going to treat employees like garbage. Yeah, if you tend to do that for a long time, again, not a lot of people are going to want to work for you. But
there's nothing there. There's nothing in that commitment. There is nothing in that commitment.
Okay. I agree. Okay. Third point, dealing fairly and ethically with our suppliers. We are dedicated to serving as good partners to other companies, large, small, that help us meet our missions.
Okay.
Great. If you treat them poorly for long enough, eventually you will not have them. So that's probably a good idea, just as good business. Supporting the communities in which we work with respect. We respect the people in our communities and protect the environment by embracing sustainable practices across our businesses. So, okay, not trashing not pooping where you live is a good idea, all right?
That's probably one of the most meaningful statements in this list of bullet points.
Generating long-term value for shareholders who provide the capital that allows companies to invest, grow, and innovate. We are committed to transparency and effective engagement with shareholders. Each of these stakeholders is essential. We commit to deliver value to all of them for the future success of our companies, our communities, and our country.
And that's the second most important aspect of this, that last thing that you just said.
Why don't you give your thoughts on why it's important? I think that all of this is just kind of vaporous.
It's too, yeah, exactly. We agree on that. This is a milquetoast statement because there are no specifics. There are not even vague specifics. I mean, there's a statement of principles here, not a statement of action. What does compensating employees fairly mean? What does that mean? And that's going to mean a million different things to a million different people, or at the very least, it's going to mean 10 different things to a million different people, right? So, without a specific commitment that means nothing. Dealing fairly and ethically with our suppliers means nothing. It means it sounds nice, but there's nothing behind what they're actually saying. And so, if you're not committing to a specific course of action, you're not committing to anything. Where I do think this is important is naming the communities that these companies do business in as stakeholders and introducing this concept of stakeholders being important as opposed to merely shareholders.
So I think that's all right. I guess I agree with you, but I would say that but that's always been the case. Mm-hmm. A lot of this, so I think, let me get to you from the from the place where I would have the most problems with this, and it's a lot of what roiled me, although it doesn't take a lot to do so, was a lot of the clickbait articles' characterizations of what this means. And if you change the law, like right now, when you form a corporation, you have a corporate charter, and you have to list what its purpose is, the corporation. You could put anything in there. You could say to never make a profit and to give all our money to charity. You could say to, you know, give all the money to the community, to whatever, to planting trees. You could list any purpose, and it's limit as long as it's legal, right? You can't do it for
that's an important distinction.
Yeah, for bad things or illegal things. And what most the vast majority of corporations that are formed, one, they're formed in Delaware, and they use the default corporate purpose statement in the charter to be for any legal purpose. So let's start with that. So everyone is free to form a corporation of any kind they like to have these five bullet points or many other bullet points or many other good things or, you know, even bad things, so long as it's legal. That has always been the law in the U.S. or for so long that it might as well have always been the law. And then the case law that developed around corporate law is quite a lot of intrigue around it. But the bottom line is, the people that form the corporation, that give money to it, that start it up, the founders and the people that give money to the founders to get a startup going, that they have fiduciary duties to one another. They can't cheat each other, right? They can't just swindle one another and lure investors in and say, oh, sure, we're going to give you profits. And then the next day, write them out and say, ha ha, we got your money and we're going to just do whatever we want with it and not give anything back to you. So there's, and that kind of stuff did exist. Those kind of swindles and worse would occur in earlier days, a long time ago. And so this body of law developed that people that are involved in corporations are fiduciaries of one another, meaning that they have to look out for each other's best interest, and that includes the shareholders. And this is where we get to the issue of, you know, the often characterized, you must maximize the quarter's profits, right, at all costs to sate the shareholders. And that's not an accurate reality of what corporate law is, but it's portrayed as that. And frankly, a lot of corporations do abide by that. They run their businesses like that, and it's not the smartest thing on earth, to put it mildly. There have been a lot of business studies that show something called the greedy search, the greedy algorithm, is often suboptimal and actually a lot of times ruinous when you just constantly looking for the most reward in the next step versus a long-term view. But a lot of times in the press, it gets portrayed as like, it's not possible. You're not allowed to look for long-term returns in your business. You have to sate the shareholders. And that's not so by law. I mean, shareholders can always sue you and demand that you do better. And sometimes they have a good point, sometimes they don't, and oftentimes they don't. But that doesn't mean it's somehow required by law that you must maximize returns per quarter.
What about the fiduciary responsibility to the shareholder? How's that fit in there?
Well, that makes total sense, because the shareholders, they gave their money to start the company. Let's start with, you know, kind of an easy example. Or let's say a friend of ours we know that invented the solar powered lamp, right? We know the guy that made the Lucy, and he starts a business and he wants it to go, but he can't, you know, he doesn't have enough capital to get it going. So he asks four or five of his buddies, are they interested in this company? And they say, okay, we believe in you, and here's, you know, a substantial amount of our cash, and you'll do good things with it, right? You're not just going to take that money and run away to a wonderful Caribbean island and bilk us for this. So he has a duty to them, and they and if they're, you know, directors or management of the company, they also have duties. But you can't just bilk your shareholders. The people that invest in it, you have to have a fiduciary duty to them to look out for their interests, so basically as if they were your own.
Is it how to interpret that, which is the sort of the pivot point upon which many shareholder lawsuits reside? is how to interpret whether or not you are honoring your fiduciary responsibility.
So think about So in some ways, people say it is our law is inefficient, right? Like we should do more than just put in the charter for any legal purpose, right? Like there should be better kind of morality around it. And I think a lot of people can agree with that. The problem is that sounds so easy, but it's really difficult to codify. Because if you tell me I have to look out for my community, if that's by law, I must consider the community as much as I do the shareholders, or more than the shareholders, that no business can form on that. It's like, so if you start a pizzeria with you and your kid and your wife, kind of thing, a real family business, you know, you're doing this for income, right? And if purportedly, if you have a bad product and you're treating your customers poorly, well, you're not going to stay in business long. So that's a vacuous win. But if you're like, you have to maximize the benefit to the community, right? If that were the tenant, well, that means that you should charge zero or you have no profit or something like that. And that's not tenable, right? If you put in that kind of specter. So when people were forming these laws, they were frustrated by how do we get this balance? And ultimately, I think they did the right thing. They said, look, a lot of this will work itself out in the marketplace. And what we want to do is we want to provide a rule that lets most people do good and right things. And hopefully we'll have other rules to deal with the people that try to abuse the system, right? So the idea is to let lots of businesses start, launch, flourish, and either meet the needs or wants of people without getting in their way. And then for people that are doing really bad things like antitrust, they're like, okay, well, we have to come up with antitrust rules because of the abuses that happen when you do there. So that's kind of the underlying ethos of how the laws develop there. And, you know, I think reasonable people can put forth an argument like, I wish it was better. I wish it was more moral. But there's a price to pay for that, right? The unintended consequences of doing that hurt other people. So what they were trying to do is kind of make a micro kernel, like a very minimal set that can launch these things. And then when the problems happen, there are other ways to deal with them rather than putting in requirements on every corporation that's ever formed legally.
Right. And that certainly would be a tricky, to your point, that would be a tricky thing to try to enforce, interpret, et cetera.
Sure. So let me give you a great example for the long-term versus short-term thing. And you said interpretation. If you make a company that sells the pet rock, right, you're making a fad product, right? It makes total sense that you might be looking for short-term returns, right? Because, you know, okay, people are going to play with the pet rock until the next fad comes out. This business is 2 years max kind of thing. Okay. And then you may be looking for a business like SpaceX, right, where my gosh, you know, it's going to take decades for this to develop, or molten salt, thorium nuclear reactors, right? Like the return is not going to come in the next quarter. It's not going to come in the next 5 years. You know, maybe 15, 20 years from now, we start getting a return. So when you're maximizing, even if the goal, and there's nowhere in the laws that says you must maximize profit, right? By the way, that's not there. You have to look out for the shareholder interest. That doesn't mean you maximize profit. A lot of times it does, but it's not literally there like people suspect it is. It's just you have to treat them as fiduciaries, and you have to look out for the good interests of the shareholders as well, which in some cases means, yes, absolutely, for the pet rock, you want short-term gain because that's what this play is. And for other things, if you play for the short-term, you're gonna shoot yourself in the foot. You have to look out for the long-term and forego profits for quite a while because you're building, you know, to something that's going to take quite a while. And so even when you say you think it's subject to interpretation in any one instance, and I agree with you, it is, but the instance also changes how it will be interpreted, right? Because the nature of the business, the nature of the shareholders is different in every time. So it's so difficult to codify that.
All right. So let's cut to the practical realities of today. I think Apple is a company that often does things for local stakeholders, particularly in regards to the environment, more so than probably any other, certainly any other huge mega corporation on the planet.
I agree with you
on in terms of the environment. But then, like for instance, developing water recycling in emerging markets where there are factories where there are no laws requiring them to do so, LOL, for instance.
Sure.
And you know, removing hazardous chemicals and, you know, things like that. These are things where Apple has gone, really should be setting the bar. Another company, it would be great if other companies were trying to copy them on that. But then Sure. You've got a thing that you and I have disagreed on in the past where I argue that not paying your fair share of corporate taxes into the local economy where you are doing business, where your employees live, is harmful to that community. And actually, it's extremely short-sighted because the community can't support the level of employees that a company like Apple or Samsung needs. And that's an area where Apple has also led.
So we disagree on that point, and the area we disagree is I think, you know, localities are big boys and girls, and they can set the terms for whatever the tax rates they are, and they have to do the math. And if you have someone that's running the government so poorly that they didn't do the math that, hey, even if we're going to give an abate, so I live in Harlem. It has been rejuvenated, and it took a long time. And one of the key things that rejuvenated Harlem, and there's no debate about that. Like it's compared to what it was in, you know, the 70s versus now, it's totally different and much more prosperous place, and safer place unlike all stats. One of the reasons is eventually they decided to try tax abatements, so people would risk coming in there. And what they did the math on, and the locality did the math correctly. They said, you know what? We're going to have, for any new buildings that are nice and awesome that we'd like to see built here on top of the ruins of literally fallen down buildings, we're going to give abatements for 20 years, 25 years for them to build it. And that kickstarted this thing. And so they did the math and said, yeah, we're going to forego those taxes, but we're going to gain so much more in other revenue from people buying more things on the local merchants, and the tax revenues were going up through that we're a net winner because of that. And companies will do that. There's no if we look at Ireland is a lot of people look at it as a tax haven, but there's a lot of work that Apple does there, and they charge basically almost no taxes. But they did their own math and said that the other revenue we're going to get by encouraging corporations to move here with this low tax rate, our community wins many times over. And it's called the Celtic Tiger for a reason, because that totally succeeded. That locality did the math correctly, and for them, it was a total win.
At the expense of other communities.
Well, so now you're telling me the communities need to have statements of principle that they're going to do right by other communities. That's what works for them. They're entitled to say this is what works for us. And
yeah, I agree with that. And this is from like Tim Cook saying to the Senate, we follow the law. If you don't like what we're doing, change the law.
So, but here's the,
right, which
and
is,
I agree,
which is a brilliant statement that he never got enough credit for.
I agree with you there. Well, actually, you know what, Tim Cook, you and I have our differences. I think he's a terrible at a lot of things in the way he runs Apple, and he's not very good at operations. But what he is amazing at is he is an amazing statesman. This guy talks to people in China and smooths things out there, which is no easy task. Then he talks to Trump and smooths things out for Apple, which is also no easy task. That he bridges a chasm that wide as a statesman is just incredible. He's incredible. Yes, I agree with you that was a correct statement. The problem occurs when you have people in the government that don't do a good job at that assessment and make really bad deals. And it doesn't work out. And But I think that's an issue.
I think that's a fuzzy issue. The thing is that the companies are also capable of doing that math, and I totally understand the reality that the darned communities, the local governments, the state government, in the case of the United States, the state, county, and or city governments, that they are the ones who are ultimately responsible. But at the same time, it, in my opinion, violates the spirit of this new thing that these companies are supposedly signing off on, to ask for the kinds of tax relief, tax credits, tax abatements, whatever, that cripple the community after the company is there.
We totally disagree, and I'll tell you why that's wrong. The tax levels that were here in Harlem were anti-business in every way, which was proven because there was like nothing going on. And it shows that at a certain point in kind of the market of ideas for how a locality governs itself, they have to look themselves in the face and say, we're doing a bad job. We have to rethink this. And by doing that, they have succeeded wildly. So the localities, you can't constrict
that. That wasn't even aimed at companies. That was aimed at developer companies.
It was totally not just developer companies.
But it wasn't aimed at like manufacturers.
There's a Chuck E. Cheese here. The number of companies that never before would come here because of what they did with just the whole tax system here is night and day too. It's all high end shops now that are here.
Are those shops benefiting from the same abatements?
That's a really good question.
I think
the answer is no.
That it was really aimed at the residential.
But that kickstarted the demand for all those other companies that want to be here to make the taxes off of them.
Right.
But the point is that every locality is free to figure out its own solution, meaning here that was a way to work it. In another area, it might be the vice versa, where you really need to bring an industry and give them a break because that will bring the people and the expertise from which you're going to increase tax base on them, right? Because they're going to be taxpayers in the locality. So there are many ways to skin this cat, and the government should be free to act on its own interest to say, this is what works for us. This is how we see it, because we want the population to increase, or we want the population to have better service, whatever it is that the locality thinks it needs. So they have to be free to do that. And for a corporation has its interest, and the locality has its interest. They don't have to match. Meaning, sometimes you just are incompatible, right? Like I as a corporation need this kind of thing for my business to work. Otherwise, I can't make a profit. And I go to one community, and they say, "Yeah, for what we have in interest, that's not gonna. We can't give you that rate." And another locality will, and it does work for them. So it's just like, sometimes you make a deal.
Sometimes you want to sell something, but you make that deal, and then it doesn't work. I understand your point that that's on the community, but there is an aspect of companies, of large, in some cases, filthy rich corporations, playing one community off against the other, and getting a deal that ends up being poisonous for the very community that they're going
into.
This
is a different topic. Although I see what you're saying, and it's a negative. So like, once we've established the main principle of we're cool, everyone can deal for themselves. The townships and the localities and the states are big boys and girls, and they can make their rules. And the corporations are big boys and girls, and they can make their rules, and they can try to negotiate. Then we get to the idea of A, not fair dealing, right? Not unclean hands, kind of unfair dealing, and B, abuse of power. And that we have solutions for that. And that goes into antitrust, right? If you're so big that you're kind of really playing two desperate people against each other, isn't that kind of a form of antitrust?
Well, it may be, but there's no legal prosecuting attorney is ever going to go after a company for for getting a community to sign off on a deal that is poisonous to that community?
Well, one, never say never.
Tax-wise.
And two, my point is, if you're going to legislate, if you're going to try to come up with new rules, my opinion is that it's better under the rubric of something like antitrust than it is on forcing on every corporation, like, you must do this. Because corporations have different purposes and needs.
Yeah, hold on a second. I never actually wanted the law to force Apple to not get tax abatements or, you know, et cetera. What I was saying when we discussed this in the past, at least what I was thinking internally, is that Apple shouldn't ask for deals that harm the community that they're going to go into. Samsung should not ask for a deal that they have a not short-sighted obligation to themselves and a long and short-term obligation to the community that they're going into to ask for a deal that still leaves the community better off with their presence being in that community. I certainly didn't articulate it in that exact fashion, but that's what's in my head.
Well, and I still disagree with that. And part of the reason I disagree with it is a lot of times the corporation really won't know. They're just saying, this is the deal that works for me. Does it work for you? And then it's up to the community to say, well, that doesn't work for me. It harms us in this way and this way and this way. And they hopefully will negotiate to something that works, or it's just not a connection. And, you know, they go to the next place and try to find a place that will work.
You know that like the people who are making the decision, the politicians who are making those decisions, are terrified that they're going to lose that company. And the companies have all the power there. The communities have no power. And that's why I simply want for companies that are as big as Samsung or Apple or maybe even Ford to not wring every single penny that they can that you know ends up giving them a tax situation that certainly you and I couldn't negotiate and that other small companies couldn't negotiate, and that ends up leaving the community worse off.
So first of all, I disagree with your first statement. New York City just told Amazon to pound sand, and they did. They were in a position to do so. And there are places that have that shall we say market power, right? To do so. So while I agree with you that people should try to be decent, whether they're working for the corporation or the township, by the way, the township's abuses are also quite large a lot of times too towards corporations that don't have that power. But that's a topic for another day. They should try to be like, meaning you shouldn't say, well, I'll move into your community if you let me throw radioactive waste into your drinking water, right? That would be like, I need you to pass that legislation and let me poison all your children. That would be great.
Look at Samsung in Manor, Texas. Mm-hmm. M-A-N-O-R. It's actually pronounced Manor. It freaks me out every time I say it, but whatever. It's Manor. They negotiated taxes that left the classrooms, the schools, unable to cope with the number of students that came in essentially because of Samsung, because of their own factory. They were paying so little into the tax base, the school could not properly educate the children. Didn't have a good enough environment. Didn't have enough classrooms. Didn't have teachers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Because Maynard was willing to sign on. You know, wrong, shouldn't have done it. But Maynard was willing to sign on to a deal that left itself screwed. And I think that Samsung shouldn't have asked for that deal.
So I disagree with that, but. Where we might agree is, I think it never hurts to ask with regard to businesses. Like you might be in a place like, I don't know Maynard and I don't know the details, so it might be particularly gruesome in how they use their power to you know sway that government into a bad decision. But I think you should always be able free to ask. But and it's clear, well, I guess, by the results that they struck a really bad deal for the township. But again, I think the nature of that is that there should be maybe some new antitrust laws that say you cannot use your market power to really corrupt the decision process in kind of a government way or another.
I would never have expected you to say that.
So, well, my point is, it's much better to use a small patch than to rewrite all of corporate governance and say this, every corporation shall do these things, because different corporations have different needs. Different townships have different needs. 90%+ of the time, they all can figure it out. And then there are these, you know, instances of bad results. Sometimes it's incompetence. Sometimes it's abuse on both parties' parts. And you need something to deal with that. And I think the problem happens with this statement of purpose, if and the way it was mischaracterized by a lot of the clickbait, was that, like, this is going to be the new, like, any corporation that forms must have that. And that's a disaster.
And that's just patently untrue, too. The statement of purpose.
Wait, what's untrue? That it would be a disaster, or that this would be the foundations for new corporation.
Yeah, that every formation. New corporation was going to
okay. Yeah, okay.
That's ridiculous. If anything, yeah, right. I kind of took it as a, hey, we are these giant corporations. You know, if you look at these companies, I mean, the BP, British Petroleum, AT&T, Boeing, of course, Apple. By the way, I find it interesting that Tim Cook didn't get one of the fluff quotes.
I find it interesting that Tim Cook's signature isn't very cool.
I find it interesting
that they put all of the CEO's signature, not just in raster form, in vector form, so that anyone that wants to forge their signatures in the future can just have it and, you know, tweak the vectors here and there to make them not perfectly the same all the time. And that they thought that was a great idea security wise for themselves.
To that point, John, I find it very interesting that Keith Block's signature is almost exactly like mine. It's
and now I gotta look at Keith Block's
it's terrible
signature.
But Tim Cook didn't get one of the fluff quotes. You know, the fluff quotes are the
gosh, that's how you sign.
It's not quite that bad, but it's
Squid line.
It's pretty darn close. Like, I was a little shocked to see that. But the fluff quotes are the, you know, like, this new statement better reflects the way corporations can and should operate today, added Alex Gorsky, chairman of the board and chief executive officer of Johnson & Johnson. Those are fluff quotes.
Yeah,
and right. even Apple's press releases often have fluff quotes, either from themselves or from other corporations. And I'm very surprised that Tim Cook didn't get one of the fluff quotes, because he is obviously the biggest name in CEOs these days, right? Would you agree with that?
Sure. It's among the top three largest companies on the planet. So yeah,
and he's got name recognition, either as Tim Cook or Tim Apple.
Sure.
And
Tim Apple is awesome.
So what I took this as at most was like, hey, we're acknowledging the fact that we're in an unprecedented point, in time, where, you know, we are these huge companies, and that companies have never, there's never been so many huge mega corporations, and we think we ought to redefine how we're going to behave. Not that we're going to be legally required to do this, but just letting you know that this is what we're going to do, and this is what we think big companies should do.
I think that's great.
That's not to say that every company has got to do it, and I don't even think that they think that every company's got to do it. And of course, again, the statement
and every
of purpose
company
is
can. Yeah, so I agree with everything you said. And you know, whenever companies want to actually do things to be better, like, yeah, I'm not sure, unless you're an anarchist, that's a good thing. So good for them. But it's mostly fluff whatever. Though it brings up interesting things.
I hope that including the local community as quote unquote stakeholders takes root. I hope that idea takes root.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I think it's good to be to your local, you know, it's good to be a good neighbor.
It is.
Period. It is. So, no, regardless of your entity status, you should always be as good a neighbor as you can be, and try to be considerate. I mean, you can't live your lives for your neighbors, but on the other hand, you can try not to be a jerk to them. Those are not mutually exclusive.
You can try not living in other people's expenses. You know, I've told you I'm a recovering objectivist.
Yes, and you're wrong on that. But anyway, moving
on. Wrong on that? To be recovering?
Yeah, a lot of what she wrote is very on point.
Oh my god, dude!
Let's table this for another time.
The one thing that she said that stands to logic and is not tossed away by her selective grasp on facts, okay, is not living your life at other people's expense. I still hold that near and dear to my heart.
Yeah, my mom put it another way, and I always liked the way she put it.
We're talking about, we're talking about Ayn Rand, folks.
Yeah. She said, never build your happiness on other people's misery.
Yeah, that's your mom's a smart woman.
So that's a good, yeah.
All right,
many good. All right, so I think we've summarized this.
Yes, this was the topic that was fluff. This was the topic that was going to not take us very long.
Yeah, and it's good for people to do good things. So major controversy, you know, addressed there.
Yeah. All right. The next thing is a lot more interesting.
Okay.
Even though we just spent 35 minutes talking about the other thing, because that was interesting too. But the DCMA, Provision 230? Is that what it's called?
Mm-hmm.
Am I getting that? It's not Provision 230. What is it? Article 230?
Section
230. And the sort of growing movement, especially from the right, to remove, and supported by the left, ironically, to remove Article 230 from the DMCA.
Well, that would be a mistake. If idiots on the left or the right are moving for that, that's just insanity. Well,
so this notion that companies like, in particular, Facebook, Twitter, and the YouTubes, i.e. Google, have a conservative bias, and that Article or Section 230 is what protects them, is what allows them to impose their supposed bias.
So I think you've got that kind of mixed up. So let me give you what the DMCA did a bunch of things, the Communication Decency Act. But let me give you one of the most important parts of it, which is around this Section 230 of the DMCA, which is this. A lot of companies, this is shall we say, senior enough to remember the dot-com era, and when the internet was blooming in the mid-90s. A lot of companies were worried that anything they do online, they'd have all kinds of liability for things that they themselves didn't do. So if you have a forum like YouTube, right, or even a car forum, whatever it is, you'll have idiots posting horrible things that you in no way agree with, but you know they're entitled to their free speech, to their free expression, and you should not be liable for their speech and for their stupid opinions. And we kind of had this with common carrier laws with regard to AT&T, for example. You know, the phone system is awesome. It let people communicate with each other across the country. But people could use that communication to do really bad things. They could talk about bad things. They could plan bad things. They could, you know, plan attacks or bank robberies or whatever. And AT&T said, look, if we're liable for every idiot that, you know, does something bad with our system, we're just going to go out of business. We can't operate. It's untenable. And the common carrier laws were developed to say, yeah, you guys aren't liable. I mean, you know, it's a tool. People could use it for good and bad. It's not that you guys are somehow enabling this. And so what happened was during the dot-com era, all the internet companies said, we need this protection too. If we're a public forum where we're not controlling, you know, we're not the New York Times, we're not editorializing, we're not curating the content, it's just free-for-all. Anyone's posting videos and they can post videos. We need to be exempt from this. And so the Congress came up with a pretty good solution that works for, you know, the vast majority of times. They were concerned about stealing IP, but their mechanism works for more than just stealing IP, which was, look, you're not going to be held liable, but you can't editorialize, one, and two, meaning you can't pick and choose the content. But to the extent that some content is illegal, like it's infringing someone's copyright, and you get a takedown notice, then you do have to take it down within a reasonable amount of time once you're notified. And as long as you do that, as a public forum, you will be granted immunity from liability for the bad things that people do on your network, whether you're, you know, Verizon with your internet provider, or on a forum like YouTube, or on a car forum, or whatever. And even Google uses the same thing, right? Google has algorithms, and they're saying, look, we just run the algorithms. They may, the results that come up, who the heck knows? Maybe they get material that's copyright infringed or whatever, and we can't be responsible for this. So as long as they don't editorialize, then they should be also free from liability for whatever the search engine brings up. So that was the goal. The goal was you can't make these companies responsible for all the crazy idiocy that people will do in using those systems. And it comes from a good place. And then the issue becomes, as these companies editorialize more and more, you know, beyond the politics, let's just say hate speech, right? Everyone hates hate speech, right? But hate speech is legal. It's legal speech. There are famous cases where the ACLU fought to allow, you know, Nazis to march down town square and spew their hateful, horrible garbage, but they were entitled to the speech. And the idea is that more speech and more visibility and sunshine cures, you know, all these kinds of horrible things. And so it's legal. And as you start curating this, are you not working against what are the requirements in the DCMA section 230, which is thou shalt not editorialize and thou shalt not, you know, leave any takedown notices not taken down. And that's where the debate begins. Like some people say, you know, and it's true, if it's weird, because if I was for a lot of these companies, they've been editorializing for quite a long time. And if I were their counsel, I would have said, you're nuts. Unless you get a takedown notice, do not touch a single thing. Do not alter a single thing. Do not curate a single thing, because you're going to lose this status. And it's going to take a lawsuit against some of these companies. And I think there is one by, I forget the name of the group, against YouTube. Anyway, it's some outfit that's suing them and saying they are editorializing, they're picking and choosing content. And it doesn't matter if it's, you know, pro left or pro right, the fact that they're picking and choosing any content without a takedown notice violates the DMCA. And so the argument is, if you want to be a public forum that gets that exemption, don't editorialize. If you want to editorialize, great, you're like the New York Times or whatever, or like, you know, the Mac Observer, and you get to pick and choose whatever you want, but you're going to be have these liabilities. So that's the background for that legislation and kind of the purpose of it. Let me stop there because I probably bored you to death.
No, it's good. That's a very good background. So I think that the original conversation we were going to have about this was whether or not these companies should get that protection of Section 230.
So I think for them, it's going to be bad news for them. So Apple has no problem with this, right? Because Apple is a curated mini little garden, and they don't get that free pass kind of liability wise because they curate the app store. I don't know what other, you know, they've got their own website which just sells their stuff. They really don't have a public forum. But companies like Twitter, Facebook, YouTube that are open, at least ostensibly open, to anyone posting anything, and to the extent that Google starts editorializing anything, even if people say, well, we're just following our own terms of service. Yeah, I'm not so sure. The terms of service are also, to some extent, editorialization and maybe subject to not benefiting from that exemption. So like I said, if these outfits, I kind of feel for them because there is a lot of horrendous stuff, right? I mean, there's like, you know, people putting up child porn or something like that. Of course, those should be taken down, but that's literally illegal speech.
Yeah, that's covered by other laws.
But there's a lot of horror that gets posted on this, and you don't want it there. But there's a lot of horror that's spoken on the telephone, right?
That's an interesting aspect of this, John, because I have always, for the vast majority of my life, going back to my childhood, that as far back as I can recall, I have always erred towards free speech. I strongly believe that flag burning should be allowed, and I get really tense when people say that, you know, I fought in a war to protect that flag. It's like, no, you fought in a war to protect the right of some
idiot to burn that flag.
That's actually what you were fighting for, and it's an important aspect
both
of our
sides
country.
Both sides forget that famous thing. I may hate what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. That's what the First Amendment is about. I hate what you say. I hate everything about it, but I will protect it.
Okay.
That is exactly right. I agree with you.
Well, but.
Okay.
But.
But it's no longer convenient for you.
No, it's not that, man. It's the practical reality. It's the practical reality of today, where the thing that is different than it has been for the first 20 years of our existence, first 125 years of our existence as a country, is that the internet, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and YouTube's algorithm itself editorializes in ways that Google never intended, I think. Steering people directly, directly to conspiracy theories. Do not pass code. Do not collect $200. Look for a video of The Temptations, and three clicks later, you're learning all about.
But see, is flat, you say that's a bad thing, but Dave Hamilton says that he loves all conspiracy theories. So some people may be looking for that.
Hold on. Dave Hamilton says he emotionally supports all conspiracy theories. Now, I do not support his stance on that.
All right.
I do not support his stance on that in any shape, manner, or form. I've argued with him about that, but he does not say he loves them all.
All right. Well, I'm sorry. I misstated, but yes. My point, though, is that some people like a conspiracy theory.
I know some people like it. But here is this practical reality that we have today, is that the ability for nut jobs, the ability for the insane in some cases, the ability for the most vile of human beings to get together and amplify their message, we have never seen this ability before, even with the telephone that you just mentioned. When you and I are on the telephone and we're exchanging some vile hate speech between each other, which I don't think we've ever done, it's just you and me. This multiplicative effect is leading to repercussions that are truly society threatening. Look at, for instance, the ways that the Myanmar government used Facebook to organize, foment, encourage, and again organize violence toward the Rohingya people. That has already resulted in hundreds of thousands of people being displaced, and I don't even know how many people already killed. Now, this is a practical reality today. How much do we stand on a principle that was principled and designed at a time before these abilities for people to come together and amplify their message, recruit, organize, disseminate information in ways that are completely disproportionate to the belief and power of those ideas?
So first, I'm revoking your ACLU card. You're done. You're out. Secondly, I disagree. Third, just because it's an old notion, so freedom's an old notion. I guess that is that another principle we're going to get rid of?
No, come on, man.
You make a good point, but I think there are versions of this in history. You know, back in the 70s, every quarter we'd see the Soviet Union putting out its propaganda in mass. that they had 453% improvement in wheat yield.
I just finished 1984, by the way.
Yeah, and all that kind of stuff, and yet that ultimately crumbled. I firmly believe the best disinfectant to that disgusting hate speech is to have it put out in broad daylight. One, let these idiots identify themselves. Really? You want them to go underground with encryption and stuff? Let these morons self-identify themselves and say, hey, I'm a complete idiot that's pro-Nazi or whatever crazy garbage they have. And so they do that. And second, let the good arguments beat those bad statements. It has to be that way. People ultimately, if you're saying that people are just such weak-minded folks that they can't take this baloney propaganda and then take the counter argument to it, mush it in their head, and come out to the right thing most of the time, then we've got bigger problems.
So I am not arguing, John, that we need to throw free speech away. That's not my point. My point is that we have a practical reality today that means that we need to be approaching some things in some way differently. I don't know what that some way differently is.
So I don't
want to trample on free speech, but I also do not want to why are flat earthers growing? This is insanity.
Because it's hilarious.
That's not why it's growing.
And their own rocket experiments. Their own rocket experiments and their dumbfounded looks are their own best evidence. I mean, that's one of these
growing.
So
the conspiracy theories are growing.
But the pet rock grew. There's all kinds of memes and cultural little flourishes that happen. That said, I don't want to discount what you made a really good point. The amplification of even a small group to look like it is, you know, a mega group is a really, it's one of the differences, right? Mm-hmm. In kind of the technology, and should there be some kind of mechanism to help that? Well, one of the things
I don't know what the heck that mechanism would be.
Well, I like kind of like the Elon Musk proposed kind of like this. He did it more for the press, but this would work for many other entities. Like it's kind of like a Better Business Bureau for you know, news sources and information sources where you go and you have some kind of curation of that. There are other solutions that I would exhaust many more solutions before I start curbing the First Amendment.
I don't want to curb the First Amendment either.
And
I don't want to curb the First Amendment. Not certainly not in the United States. I would like to actually spread the First Amendment to you know, the principles of the First Amendment to more places.
But we're kind of getting a little bit off stages, meaning I think this is going to be very bad for these companies because they're going to find that they have violated Section 230 in not complying with it because they do curate. That said, I'm not wholly unsympathetic. I whether or not you agree there's some bias or not with the corporate leanings, and let's face it, you know, a lot of Silicon Valley is not what we call staunch, you know, conservatives, in what goes on there. But I don't think that's the major issue. I think, it is an issue, but I think it's more, these folks have the law. This is one of the few areas, believe it or not, in copyright law that's really clear cut. You have to do these two things to get this benefit. And if you don't, you're going to lose it. So they're going to be very surprised, unpleasantly, mostly because their in-house counsel are corporate cowards and didn't tell them the truth to, you cannot do this stuff. And they should have raised this issue much earlier in what to do. I think, you know, there are other mechanisms for people to flag things, right? We came up, what happened with the Decency Act is, this was a lot earlier on, and things were, frankly, a lot more amorphous and vague back then. And they came up with this kind of notification scheme where you get an alert, and then there's a takedown notice, and something needs to be done. If you get some smart people like Tim Cook and people in from Google and whatever, just people that have juice there, that can actually like say, this is going to happen. You get them in a room with no press and a few legislators, they'll come up with a few good ideas of mechanisms that you could use to not curate. I don't think these folks should be curating. You should not curate what happens in a public square. When, if I want to yell idiot things when I go to the park, I'm in, you know, as long as I'm not harassing people, I'm entitled to say my idiot things. But that said, there are a lot of damaging things. Like, meaning, I don't think this is technically illegal. Like hate speech, there's very few things. Hate speech is not illegal speech. There are very few things that are illegal. Like, you know, child porn is illegal. Yelling, anything that calls for imminent violence, like causing a riot to violently do something, is illegal speech. There's like very few things that are actually not permitted by the First Amendment. So, not. The other thing that we have solutions for in this regard that we for oddly no one's thought about, and I don't know why I'm like the only genius in this. Seriously, what we're talking about is a point to multipoint form of communication, like broadcast, right? And in broadcast, we have restrictions on what are otherwise perfectly allowable First Amendment speech topics. You can't curse. You can't, you know, show bodily things. You can't drink booze or whatever. And it's actually delineated by time for broadcast media, right? From, you know, up until 7 p.m. or whatever, you can't do anything to one level. And from 7 to 10, you can do something a little bit more risque. And then after 11, you can do the maximum risque things for broadcast media. So why isn't there a similar mechanism for what we have is indecency and obscenity laws for public forums? That's a reasonable thing to explore. The point is, you don't have to rub too many brain cells together to say that we have a history with this. We can do solutions. And the Wild Wild West is, you know, it was good to get the West won, but then it had to be tamed a bit. And we did that with broadcast media, and we could do something similar with this type of medium. But the this is, to me, a very black and white case. Those companies are going to lose. Because they're not matching that law. Period.
Here's what I'm hearing. You completely agree with me and that we need to think differently about this stuff. So I accept your apology.
Okay, well, if that makes you happy. But do you see what I'm saying? Like, but your ACLU card is revoked nonetheless. Just for you even wavering, I'm revoking it. Maybe give it back to you provisionally after enough Hail Marys or whatever.
No, I don't think that is appropriate at least what I'm thinking. All right, we had a third topic, but we're like already over, so we will save that third topic. It wasn't timely anyway, and we'll keep you in the dark as to what it was until we actually come back to talk about it. John, I want to thank you very, very much for joining me. Very enlightening discussion, very very enjoyable discussion.
Thanks. It's one of these kind of boring, droll, civics-y type things, but I think it's an important one.
Yeah, very, very, but yeah, agreed. Okay, on that note, and that's this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on, add, or question, write me at acm@macobserver.com. Our bandwidth is provided by CashFly. The bass is by Boom, recorded just for TMO, and that is all for this week. Again, John, thank you kindly.
Thank you.